Bill Gardner, host of Rhapsody in Black. I play classic rhythm and blues from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Boogie with Bill Gardner every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4 on KPFK 90.7 FM.
Rock that boogie!
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
In a dark warehouse space, dancers dressed in blue tank tops and shorts cradle small wooden beds. They move the beds around their bodies, pressing their faces into them at one point. The movements seem both intimate and melancholy. It's October 2023, and I'm watching a dance performance in San Francisco called If I Give You My Sorrows from Flyaway Productions. And the bed will show up again and again in different positions and sizes. For an hour, performers will dance with and around beds, small ones and large ones, and one that swings through the air as they twist and glide around it. But these are not just any beds. These beds are meant to evoke prison beds.
So the piece used the beds as a physical and metaphoric frame to look at the experience of women who are currently incarcerated.
This is Joe Kreider, artistic director of Flyaway Productions and the creative director of If I Give You My Sorrows.
I've been working with artists and people who are incarcerated since 2017. So with this piece, we asked the women, how is your bed an antidote to your prison experience?
Joe knows what it's like to have had an incarcerated loved one. She's created an entire series of work around the experiences of incarcerated people, including three site-specific productions in the Decarceration Trilogy. And for this show, she interviewed currently and formerly incarcerated women, sometimes for hours.
And I asked them, tell me about a bed. Tell me about your prison bed. What is a secret that only your bed knows about you? Tell me about your childhood bed. Tell me about your ideal bed. And from those questions emerged a picture of both the struggle of being in prison and the ways that women, or the women we spoke to at least, adapt.
Those words were then incorporated into some of the music composed for the performance, like this piece that includes the voice of formerly incarcerated trans activist Lisa Strawn.
This is Lisa Strawn. I'm a trans woman, and I recently was paroled after 25 years from San Quentin. I can't even begin to tell you the fear, not just myself, but everyone else had every day.
The bed is portrayed as a kind of repository for deeply private feelings and thoughts. To me, it feels like this idea of the bed challenges the ways that the prison industrial complex dehumanizes the people inside, where incarcerated human beings are often euphemistically referred to in budgets as beds. Art, though, can show the human beings inhabiting those beds. Whether through dance, visual art, or the written word, it has the power to reveal what's hidden. It can peel back the layers of censorship that are inherent to incarceration. One of the people Joe Kreider interviewed for the dance performance was Betty McKay, also known as Ms. Betty. Ms. Betty was formerly incarcerated and started off as an advocate inside prison.
I was incarcerated for 27 years. And that is a lot, particularly for women, because we are at the bottom of the totem pole for everything. I became a voice inside because we didn't have voices. And it's hard to get people to stand up to the system when you're inside because of retaliation. If you try to address an issue or you try to bring light to something, you could end up like in another prison, way away from your children, your loved ones, everything.
Joe approached Miss Betty about contributing to the dance piece.
And she was just like, Betty, I want you to tell your story and we're going to do it into dance. And I was like, what? My story? And she was like, yes, you have a story. And so I just, I showed up at the studio. They put me in a booth. They asked me a million questions. I answered as authentically as I could. It got emotional at times. Just the memories of some of the things that I went through touched me. I didn't know that I still had triggers to things from my incarceration, but I did. And a lot of that came through in the dance, and you heard me saying the words. When I heard them, I got emotional at the performance.
My bed now, when I came home, my bed now is the antidote for a lot of things. I look at my room now and I be like, thank you, Lord, thank you. Rubbing my body on those satin sheets. My bed now. My bed is a confidant. Satin sheets.
Wow. I mean, I just remember when I was watching the performance, just being so struck by your words in particular. And I went back through and listened to it again before this interview. And just, you know, the words and the music, and I think the emotion, you know, really, really comes through in that section. And there's a line where you say something like, my bed now, when I came home, is an antidote to a lot of things. And I'm just wondering, could you describe what you meant by that?
Oh, I don't know why. I'm just like almost crying right here, right now, thinking of that. Because what I know to be true is that the bed, it was like I never really thought about my bed. But my bed was like the only place that I could be like totally authentic with myself. Like I could cry in my bed, because even though I was someone in the prison that everyone looked for to solve problems and to make things happen and to do different things, every day wasn't a good day for me. But I couldn't be like that outside of that bed. That bed is the only place that I could be alone with myself and my thoughts.
27 years. It was hard, very hard. 27 years. And every day, and just lie there.
I would just like to encourage people to take the time to reimagine who and what incarcerated people are and what they can do and what they're capable of. Because what I know to be true is that what I did to be in prison isn't who I am. It's what I did. Everyone has a story. And you don't know me unless you know my story. So you can't judge me unless you know my story.
This project made me reconsider what my bed means to me, which I hadn't thought of much before. It made me think of how the bed as an object, this piece of furniture I use every day that's made specifically for my rest, holds so much intimacy and care. But that also makes the absence of the system of care in prisons and other carceral facilities so stark in comparison.
It was hard in there. In some days, was harder than others. And some days that bed was comforting. And so it's like everything that I went through, everything that I was feeling in my heart, in my soul, could only be shared with my bed. And when I came home, once I got a job and had a little bit of money and was able to get a little bit of credit, the bed was the first thing I bought. That was the first thing I bought for myself after 27 years of incarceration, was the bed. And right now today, that bed still means the same thing to me.
I'm just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. I'm Lucy Kang. Earlier on today's show, we heard about a dance performance highlighting the experience of women who are incarcerated and the complex ways they relate to their beds. In the next half of the show, we're going to look more closely at a related art exhibition and what it tells us about how people outside prison walls, including those who are formerly incarcerated, can support and uplift the voices of women inside. The question that Joe Kreider built the dance performance around was, how is your bed an antidote? And that question was also used as a prompt for a visual art and poetry exhibition called The Only Door I Can Open, featuring work from artists and writers inside Central California Women's Prison, or CCWF, in Chowchilla. The exhibition, like the dance piece, was a collaboration between Empowerment Avenue, the Museum of the African Diaspora, and Flyaway Productions. Two women currently inside that prison curated and contributed to The Only Door I Can Open. You'll hear their voices in the rest of the episode. They were recorded on calls made from inside prison, and as you'll be able to tell, the prison phones don't have the best quality. And you'll also hear how that quality changes depending on which recording we used. Here's one of the exhibition's curators, writer and poet Tamikia Johnson.
You know, we all have to process a really abstract question that some of us probably never considered. And that was, what is our bed? A woman's bed here is much more than where she puts pajamas on, goes to sleep, wakes up. You know, it's so much more than that.
Artist and writer Chantel Jeanette Black is the other curator. She's been a painter since before she was incarcerated.
So for a lot of us, our bed was that sanctuary, which is expressed either in poetry or through visual art. And so we kind of like got to expose that suppression through how we are under constant surveillance. We're always exposed in our most vulnerable moments.
When it first launched, The Only Door I Can Open was shown in a gallery space near the dance performance venue in San Francisco. Paintings, drawings, and works with poetry hung on the walls, And what stood out to me was just how differently the artists responded to the question about their beds. One of the pieces on display was a poem Tamikia wrote called My Bunk Bed as an Antidote. This poem is where the title of the exhibition came from. Here's an excerpt recorded in her voice from within the prison.
I've been giving it some thought about how the only door I can open in prison is an invisible one leading to my bunk bed. It calls me when it wants and needs me. Sometimes it betrays my insomnia, giving me a few drips of sleep.
I want to turn now to look at what it took for Tamikia and Chantel to curate the show from inside prison. One of the first steps was finding other incarcerated artists to work with. That wasn't easy because of the restrictions placed on them by the prison. Plus, the planning process took place during COVID lockdowns. Here's Chantel.
It was very challenging within this particular institution because I believe we are currently the nation's or one of the top largest prisons within the world. And so it's very big for a women's institution specifically, not in comparison to men's. We have three separate yards. And within those three separate yards, we can't really intermix. Like, I'm not allowed on another yard.
The yards are named alphabetically. During the time that they were planning the show, Tamikia was in C as in Charlie Yard, while Chantel was in B as in Bravo Yard. When the project kicked off, they were in the same yard, but then later got moved to different ones. So they used a go-between, but not a person. It was a notebook, one of those lined composition journals I remember from school.
Tamika and I came up with a wonderful plan of a notebook that we can pass around. So when you go to education or medical or the law library or wherever we go where we know we can meet up, we can pass the notebook and say, can you get this to so-and-so? Can you get this to the next unit? And then people, it's like a prison culture to say, like, can you pass this notebook or can you pass this letter to somebody? That it's pretty common to do that. That is one tool that we use to overcome the barrier of being separated, being on quarantine, and having limited access to one another.
The notebook included a description of the project and a list of potential artists that grew as the notebook made its way around the prison.
It took a lot of effort to coordinate between Tamika and I to get that notebook between the yards. We would meet on main yard at the law library and be able to switch it off there and pass it around. And sometimes it was definitely during COVID, so we had to wait a few weeks at times.
Chantel explains their strategy through a phone call. Halfway through, you'll hear an automated voice break in. It's just one reminder of the many limitations on communications inside prisons.
So because of the COVID quarantines and the limited networking and person skills, we had to do a little more of by word. So, you know, by word of mouth, so through the grapevine, like, do you know any...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And we kind of had a trust on reputation.
Then, once the artists were selected, Chantel and Tamikia worked with them to produce their pieces. Here's Tamikia again.
I offered them art supplies. I helped them write their biographies, artist statements, art descriptions, and I broke down the value of their pieces, teaching them how to evaluate them.
Prisons, jails, and detention centers are built on the logic of confinement, of surveillance, and of erasure from public life. And that means the voices of people who are incarcerated are routinely censored, even though they are the only ones who can really speak to the human impacts of incarceration. Chantel also made work for the show. One really stood out to me. Letter to My Bed features a poem painted onto a bedsheet with images of a tree, moon, and sun.
And I actually wrote the letter on an actual sheet. It is a PIA, and that's Prison Industry Authority sheet that we are all issued when we come into the prison. We each get two sheets, a pillowcase, and the basics.
The California Prison Industry Authority sheets are made by incarcerated people and distributed inside prisons for them to use.
And in the prison,
in this particular prison. They put 8 women in one room, which is about 18 by 18 feet, square feet. So it's not a lot of space. Your bunk space is really where we live, cook, do our homework, our study time, our meditations, our reflection. And with 8 other people in the room, the only way you can feel like you're alone is by hanging up a sheet, either clipping it up or tying a shoelace from one end of the bunk post to the other end and hang your sheet over it. So I wrote a letter thanking the sheet for the privacy and the solitude that it gives me with the illusion of separating myself in my own little space from everyone else.
Chantel then painted the words and images onto the sheet with a paintbrush, working with a paperclip for the finest lines. She then used a hairdryer to heat set the paint so the sheet could be washed. Here's an excerpt from that poem in her own voice.
I am utmost grateful for the illusion of privacy that you provide when I hang my sheet across your line. You have been my only resource for healing the abundance of scars within and without. It is only here where I can close my eyes and be the mother I was meant to be, where I can hold her again, laugh and play with my family. I can release all the tears felt from grief through the years. Time has no meaning other than knowing the world outside continues without me.
As curators of The Only Door I Can Open, Chantel and Tamikia were supported by the organization Empowerment Avenue. I first heard about Empowerment Avenue through their projects to help writers who are incarcerated get their work published. The organization's executive director is Rahsaan New York Thomas. You might have heard him as a host on the award-winning podcast Ear Hustle.
This program got started because I needed it. I was in prison and I was writing about what I was witnessing. I became a person who was working for the newsroom, writing articles for San Quentin News. I became a co-host of Ear Hustle. And I also got involved in making documentary films. But I needed more. I felt like the economic piece was missing. And I felt like at a certain point, I was just preaching to the same people, preaching to the choir. And so I longed to get my voice past the choir into bigger ponds and to like get economically compensated for it. And at the same time, I was watching the artists around me give their art away to nonprofits. So economic empowerment was critical. And so Empowerment Avenue started as a concept that I saw was necessary because as a writer, I only got 8 stories published in 7 years and only made $400 on my own. But meanwhile, it was a guy I was incarcerated with. He had made a connection with an editor at a magazine who not only hired him to be a columnist, but acted as a person who would help him pitch his stories to other organizations. And he was getting published left and right. And I was like, man, not only do I need somebody like that, everybody needs somebody like that if you're a writer and you're incarcerated.
Editors who are willing to work with writers inside prisons provide really crucial access to platforms that are otherwise denied to them. And Empowerment Avenue tries to facilitate relationships that get incarcerated artists and writers published and paid. Rahsaan was an interesting person to talk to for this story because he's also worked as an art curator. That's during his time inside San Quentin.
First of all, I started out like not knowing how to curate anything, but just knowing that certain artwork was beautiful to me and wanting to share that artwork, what I saw with the world.
So Rahsaan knows firsthand about the challenges that Chantel and Tamikia went through. And just like them, he had to learn how to manage time. Things sometimes take longer in prison, like longer than you think, especially during the height of COVID lockdowns.
I kind of plan for it. Like, I know that prison's going lockdown, so I can't wait till the last minute. You have to work ahead of time and not behind and make it happen. I think the most interesting part for me is as a curator for the first time, I'm asking people to give me their artwork in January, in December, in November for a show then basically almost a year away, 9-10 months away. And so they have to trust my vision, right? They have to believe in me. And so having those relationships with all these guys in place was really key. And I'm honored that they did trust me. They all gave me their artwork. Then everybody in that exhibit made $600 off the top. And so I'm really proud of that. that we were able to do that and set a new trend. Like normally when you're in a museum, all you get is exposure. This time we got the guys paid.
Rahsaan took what he had learned and wrote a guide to share with Chantel and Tamikia as they prepared to curate The Only Door I Can Open. It was just one way that he and his colleague, Christine Lashaw, Director of Visual Arts for Liberation, supported them.
From start to finish, it was a lot of teamwork, a lot of communication, a lot of letter writing, and a lot of phone calls. This is the first exhibit I have ever curated or co-curated. Honestly, this project, this whole exhibit would not be possible without the collaborative teamwork and open line of communication that Tamika and I both had with Empowerment Avenue. And I always felt like I was included, like my voice was being heard. And we moved into the actual production days. They did a video visit with me where I could see the actual art space, the museum space. I got videograms of the dance production. Like, it was so thorough and so professional. It exceeded all my expectations.
For Rahsaan, it was especially important to uplift the voices of incarcerated women. Incarceration impacts the over 190,000 women and girls currently held in prisons, jails, and correctional and detention centers in the United States differently than it does men.
I feel like women are not given the honor and respect that they deserve in this world in general, and incarcerated women, forget about it. For example, the men's prison has access to all its art supplies and a thriving art program, and the women's prison did not have that. And they're the fastest growing prison population. And Chowchilla is one of the, if not the biggest, women's facility in the country, if not the world. And so we need to shine some light on how things are done there and what needs to be improved.
In fact, the Prison Policy Initiative says that, quote, women in prison are worse off than men, both leading up to and during their incarceration. And that's troubling because the number of women being incarcerated is rising at double the rate of men. And the thing is, we don't really know why that is, because the data is inconsistent or incomplete. And gender-based violence definitely plays a role. Women are often incarcerated for fighting back against their abusers. Incarcerated women are three times as likely as men to be sexually abused by prison or jail staff. And that's for women across the board, without slicing it down even further into women of color and queer and trans women. Prisons and other carceral institutions are dehumanizing, but art can push against that. It can remind us of the brutality, punishment, and control inherent to prisons, and instead help us imagine communities that are built on care. Care that acknowledges our humanity, like healthcare for everyone, and education and housing, and having a bed that's not in a cage. Here's Chantel.
So the thing that's really important that I hope people get out of this exhibit is to see the humanity and individuality of women incarcerated. Having that artistic platform to speak up and be heard, that is invaluable to me. It's just so precious and important for each one of us to be able to speak up and be heard and seen as the mothers, daughters, sisters that we are, not what the media portrays people incarcerated to be.
The Only Door I Can Open and If I Give You My Sorrows are collaborations between Flyaway Productions, Empowerment Avenue, and the Museum of the African Diaspora. You can catch The Only Door I Can Open starting February 1st and If I Give You My Sorrow starting January 31st at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. The music you heard in this episode was composed for If I Give You My Sorrows, and the album is available for purchase online. And that does it for today's show. I'm Lucy Kang. Thanks for listening.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
$10 might seem like a small amount,
But when you sign up as a KPFK Sustainer Circle member, that $10 helps pay for daily broadcast of Democracy Now!, the Tom Hartman Program, and all of the news and information you hear on KPFK. You get a lot for your monthly contribution, and we need that gift right now to keep bringing you all of the programs you count on. $10 makes a big impact. We combine it with contributions from your fellow listeners who rely on KPFK as much as you do. Public radio only works with you. This is Kathy Diaz, the Monday host of The Global Village, encouraging you to contribute now. Go to kpfk.org, then click Sustainer Circle. Whatever you can do, please do. Thank you.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next,
we'll present the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. She's Beautiful explores the emergence of a political thought that challenged systems of patriarchy. This documentary provides important historical insight at a time when our country is experiencing regression around issues of reproductive rights, equity in the workplace, and violence against women.
The argument has been over for a very long time. Yes. To have the right to choose. We should be mad. Are you mad?
You're not allowed to retire from women's issues. You still have to pay attention because somebody's trying to yank the rug out from under you. And that's what's happening now.
The feminists who are here tonight, do you not believe a woman's place is in the home, right?
As feminists, what we believe in is very simple, and that is the social, economic, and political equality of the sexes. Because the relationship between the sexes is, in fact, a political relationship. We're an oppressed group, and we have been through history. We have to.
If you do something as remarkable as changing the relationship between the sexes, everything is at risk, every possible idea. And many people don't like it, especially men don't like it. They're very threatened by it.
Women's Lib really is a lot of insignificant people that are really trying to gain their own interests and boost their own ego by making brash statements or being on television or what have you.
You're so oversensitive, Audie. Why are you so sensitive?
We don't like being so sensitive. It's not pleasant. We don't like having to always be catching things. We'd rather they didn't exist. But as long as people are going to be insensitive to our position, we're going to have to keep correcting them because there's no other way to change the consciousness.
Women, given their educational status, can earn 60% of what men of the same education can. What that really means is that a woman with college education, BA, earns what a man does who has 3 years of high school. This is economic discrimination and exploitation.
Women as well as men told me I was wrong over and over again. Women are not oppressed. Or what does it matter? Who cares? You have a lot of influence. You were working against cultural norms. You're working against institutions.
How do you feel about women's liberation?
Woman's place is more at home than to advance herself too much.
Totally against it. I feel I don't know what they're being liberated from.
Many women protested that they like cooking and housework and catering to men. But I would argue with some woman who was being extremely defensive about the movement and then 6 months later would run into her at a demonstration.
Prior to the women's liberation movement, most women were conditioned to meet the needs and expectations of men. But the introduction of this new feminist thought allowed women to view themselves as full human beings, equally capable of defining themselves and deciding their own paths.
As the civil rights movement dominated the world center stage, women weren't content with being excluded from the conversations of resistance and liberation. Their issues needed to be prioritized as well, activist Frances Beale.
The Black Liberation Movement had come into its fore, and you're talking about liberation and freedom half the night on the racial side, and then all of a sudden men are going to turn around and start talking about putting you in your place.
If you don't want any trouble.
That was the contradiction in terms that we were no longer prepared to put up with. So 1968, we founded the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee to take up some of these issues.
A number of women felt that we need to go off on our own and focus on what we needed to do in our fight for liberation.
I was a graduate student at Berkeley. And one day I saw a little 3x5 card in the student union, and it said a women's group forming. And these consciousness-raising groups spontaneously grew up in many areas of the country.
When I first heard about the women's liberation movement, I had two little kids under five. My connection with the world was, I felt, finished. During one of my crises of feeling that my life was over, I heard some young women talking about meetings they were having, and they were talking about women's liberation, and they gave the address of a meeting. So I went to this meeting, and there were these women talking about their lives as I had never imagined people could.
Well, you need to be specially trained to be a housewife. You get married, there are a whole new set of rules. We still have to look a certain way and be a certain way. But there's a whole lot more.
We went around the room, and people asked a very simple question. How would your life have been different if you had been a boy?
Why do you think being a woman might limit you as a human being, your possibilities, you know?
Welfare people and whatnot.
We challenged concepts of masculinity. We challenged concepts of femininity. We talked about skin color, how young black women would put cream on in order to make themselves light-skinned.
Suddenly, everything was up for questioning. Women did all of the family and housework and cooking, and the men got to make the living and get all of the attention in the world. Why was that?
Like, we don't even realize what goes on until we sit and compare with other women.
And we heard each other. We heard each other into speech. You could sense it. You could feel it. You could cut it with a knife, as they say. The room was electric with whatever was going to be shared.
So I said, I've had three abortions, and the last one was within the last year. And I started to cry because I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that what I had considered personal embarrassment was something that was part of this whole larger experience.
The big insight of the women's movement was the personal is political. Problems that you felt were happening to you alone probably were your fault. But if it's happening to other people, then it's a social problem and not just a personal problem.
The framing of women's oppression as a societal construct put all the daily personal challenges that women faced into a new broad context. For the first time, women were openly broaching subjects that generations before were too fearful to speak of. Women were demanding the right to control their own bodies and lives without permission from men or the state.
Thousands of women in the United States are hospitalized each year because of post-abortion complications. 5,000 of these women die.
I had a very good friend in high school who went away to college, and she subsequently had an illegal abortion and died. So within 3 or 4 months of going off to college, she was dead.
People tried to self-abort. My best friend took pills, and she had the miscarriage in the dorm shower with the turned on really hard, hoping the noise would muffle her cries of pain.
Some were able to find an abortionist. Some had to have the child that they didn't want. All those kinds of experiences we discovered were universal. And abortion became our big unifying issue.
Women have a fundamental right to control their own bodies and to control their own lives.
Our bodies, our lives, our right to decide.
Not since the suffragettes fought for the right to vote has an issue been more critical to women than abortion.
Somewhere around 1970, I went to an abortion rights rally in San Francisco. And it was a sea of white women, very few women of color. And someone grabbed a bullhorn and asked for the African-American women who were there to gather under a tree. And we decided that we would form a group called Black Sisters United. I was very glad that, you know, somebody called African-American women together and said, you know, maybe we have something to talk about that might be a tiny bit different from what's coming from the stage. And indeed we did.
I was invited up to Harlem to speak at a event around abortion. Remember, in the Black Liberation Movement, the big debate is abortion is genocide, women should have babies for the revolution. And I remember going up those stairs and my knees were literally knocking because this was a bunch of nationalists and I was really scared. I concentrated a lot about the deaths of Black women as a result of illegal abortion and how we should be able to choose when we want to have children. So I managed to survive, you know, some of the attacks. And on my way out, twice it happened. One woman said to me, whispered to me, "Thank God you speak up. Thank God you're speaking up." And another, as I was approaching the door, said, "Right on. Right on."
Dear brothers, poor Black women decide for themselves whether to have a baby or not have a baby. Black women are being asked by militant Black brothers not to practice birth control because it's a form of whiteys committing genocide on Black people. Well, true enough. But Black women in the United States have to fight back out of our own experience of oppression, and having too many babies stops us from teaching them the truth, from supporting our children, and from stopping the brainwashing, as you say, and fighting Black men who still want to use and exploit us.
It was very difficult for middle-class white women to have any conception about what was going on in communities of color. And those differences could have been in conversation with each other, but if there isn't even an acknowledgement that there's differences in experience and perspective, and the voice of one is used as the voice of all, then you have a problem.
That was during a period when Black women did not particularly identify with the women's movement.
Mrs. Norton, why are you a Black woman involved in women's liberation?
I'm involved in the struggle for women's rights because I believe women are disadvantaged. Black women are no less than white women. Indeed, Black women far more than white women. Women who have spent their lives working in other women's kitchens have a different kind of handicap than women who have been oppressed for their sex in other ways.
We were grappling with that idea of how do you integrate race, class, and gender. That's the reason why we had some reservations about the term feminism, because feminism was just seemed to be dealing with the female aspect of your being.
It's important to keep in mind that Black women are organized in their own organizations, in their own version of Black women's liberation.
In 1964, a friend mentioned that his sister was pregnant and nearly suicidal. Could I do anything about it? And I was referred through a series of connections to a doctor, asked him if he would perform an abortion. He said yes. And a few weeks later, someone else called and said they also were looking for an abortion. The word had spread. And at that point, I decided to set up a bit of a system. I was living in a dormitory at the time, and so I told people to ask for Jane. I could tell within the first minute what they were calling about, because there was a pause, there was a hesitance, there was a tension. Many were frightened, because three people discussing an abortion in those days was a conspiracy to commit felony murder.
Jane was this service that was established in Chicago that provided abortions when abortion was illegal. We would have women call us who were in need of the abortion service. And of course, having Jane available without having to refer them to the mob was a godsend.
The group would take in the calls and we would do counseling. Then women would be brought to specific houses on a rotating basis where the procedures would be done.
The service moved every day from somebody's home to somebody's home, which is quite amazing.
I joined the abortion service because I knew that women are sometimes desperate and they are going to hurt themselves in order to end their pregnancies. When I began Jane work, a few dozen women a week were coming through. After about 6 months, there were at least 100 women coming through. Ultimately, one really good abortionist taught Janes how to do abortions with skill and care. And then those Janes taught other Janes. All of us were always aware that what we were doing was illegal, that we could go to jail. You might have to throw everything in your bag and run down the back stairs at any moment. But we understood that it was important work, useful work, necessary work.
What is the relationship of the movement to the whole question of motherhood and the affection of mothers for children and so forth?
It's about being able to have children if you want them and being able not to have children if you don't want them. And if you want to have your kids in daycare centers, if you want to work, then you can do that too.
In the women's movement, the myth was that we hated men, we hated marriage, we hated children. That's not right. The group I was in, we talked mostly about childcare being the absolute precondition for women's emancipation.
One of the earliest battles was for childcare. It's a now statement of purpose. We knew that women could not hold jobs and be promoted until society recognized its obligation to help take care of our children.
And I remember at some of the early demonstrations, those who had kids, we would bring the kids. And people would say things like, oh, we can't talk with you nursing the babies and stuff like that. And we would say, show us the daycare center. We'll be happy to bring the kids to the daycare center.
Feminists are accused of wanting women out of the home and leaving children come what may.
We proclaim that when we talk about 24-hour child care, we mean to have.
After a great deal of work where feminists were in the leadership, we got close to having a real child care system.
In 1971, amazingly enough, the women's movement, the Congress, the Senate, passed a comprehensive child care act. Most historians don't even remember that. Forget about the rest of society. And President Nixon vetoed it. He said, we don't want to make our women like Soviet women. We want women to take care of their own children.
That was a tragic moment in history. And we've been paying for it ever since. It's one thing for women to pay the price. It's another thing for generations of children to pay the price as well. I can think of, frankly, of no more important issues that early feminists raised than educational child care.
Poor people, black women, women on welfare, are often sterilized against their will. I mean, that's been known to happen.
The same hospital that wants to sterilize the black women will not let a middle-class white woman be sterilized. If she says, I don't want to have any more children, they say, you have to
be crazy.
You've got to tell me you have to have a medical reason. You have to be sick. There has to be something wrong with you.
Those things are two ends of the same dimension. It's still the issue of control over one's body, whether it's the right to have children if you want them, or the right not to.
In Puerto Rico, over one-third of the women on the island have been sterilized. That means over one-third of the women are never going to be able to hold a baby in their arms.
Women in Puerto Rico were used as guinea pigs, as a way of controlling the population. And then with that sterilization program being brought to New York City, we actively organized raising the consciousness about this. The Young Lords Party was dedicated to issues affecting Puerto Ricans in the United States. We were the first ones to begin to articulate an idea of reproductive justice. It's just as important for women in our communities to be able to have children, raise children that don't go hungry, have daycare, as well as have access to birth control and the right to a safe abortion. The kind of developing feminism that we had in the Young Lords was make very clear decision not to separate, to wage struggle internally with our brothers. The men had written this program. One of the points dealt with revolutionary machismo. What an oxymoron. We weren't having it. So we formed a women's caucus and made demands on the men in the organization. It was ultimately changed to, we want equality for women. Down with machismo and male chauvinism. It was important that it's not just women making that statement. It should be men saying, yo, brother, that's really a macho attitude you're taking. You need to check your... And that's what happened.
You're listening to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr. This is Making Contact. Subscribe to our podcast or sign up for updates by logging on to our website at radioproject.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Now back to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry.
One evening in my Tuesday night consciousness raising group, West Village One of New York Radical Feminists, Diane Crothers walked in with a newspaper, It Ain't Me Babe, from San Francisco, and said, there's an article here we all have to read. And it was a story about a woman in Marin County who'd been raped during a hitchhike. We read the article and we went around the room, and it turned out one woman, Sarah, had been raped. And the police said to her, who'd want to rape you?
A friend of mine was raped at knife point in her bed in off-campus housing. I went with her to the Student Health Service, and she was given a lecture on her promiscuity.
It was very common in a courtroom to blame the woman for the rape. And rape was looked at as a crime that occurred because a man had strong sexual urges that he couldn't satisfy any other way. And it was only with the feminist women that it came out that rape is not a crime of passion. It's a crime that expresses the urge to dominate.
People who are not used to thinking of rape as a political crime against women. That was our slogan. Rape is a political crime against women.
I think the most profound thing that feminism did for me was to make me feel that I was capable of genuine freedom. Before the women's movement, I had my own work. I knew I wasn't going to live a traditional woman's life. I felt that I probably wasn't going to have children. And ultimately, I did have my daughter. And I think, were it not for feminism, I don't think I could have done that.
Right after I got out of college, it was November 2006, my mother passed away, and I got all of these letters and emails from her friends, her colleagues, all of the feminists that started Women's Liberation Movement. And I started to realize that even though I was down with the word feminism, I didn't really know what it meant to me and to our generation. I think the sexism that we experience is a little bit more insidious, and it's harder to sort of point out and say, see, that's sexism. But I know a lot of young kick-ass feminists out there. They're blogging, they're out in the streets, they're organizing. There's this new movement called Slut Walk that has now swept 70 different cities. And it was started by a young woman who heard a cop say about a woman who was raped, well, she was asking for it, she was dressed like a slut.
Believe it or not, people are assaulted regardless of what they wear. Some people who get raped are in burqas.
NYPD rape is a felony!
We created a revolution that we are still debating in our society. We're still arguing over many issues that women raised 40 years ago, like abortion, like childcare. We still don't have any childcare.
In terms of reproductive health, reproductive justice, we've gone backward in a big way.
The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
This fight is not over. This fight is not
over. Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bowl, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr.
Wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. Today's intro music was by Maya Jane Coles. Thanks for listening.
Hello, relatives. You are listening to 90.7 KPFK Los Angeles. My name is Sunrose Ironshell, and I'm out here on the Great Plains. I am Sichangzu and Ogallala Lakota, and I've missed you on Be a Better Relative, the Eagle and Condor with myself and
Lydia Ponce here from the west side from Venice, hailing on Tangva Land. I am Quechua and Mayo, Yoreme. And we'll be back this new year, 2025. We just wanted to reach out and encourage and inspire you to be a better relative.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds,
and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups.
And through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation.
To promote the study of political and economic problems.
And of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.